Welcome to the Interracial John Podcast. I'm your host, Leslie Mack, and I'm joined, as always,
by a very white guy.
And you are very white indeed. What's going on, my friend?
I'm infused with extra 4th of July whiteness.
Ugh, yeah.
It was a little different this year. I felt like last year, I guess every year, shouldn't say last year, but like since forever and ever, 4th of July is, you know, generally pretty white. It's pretty high on the white scale. Mm. But, you know, you and I read specifically Frederick Douglass's 5th of July speech. You know, what does the 4th of July mean to the Negro kind of, yep. You know, the best couple of years, and really taking that to heart. And I think Twitter in particular and social media in particular,
yeah,
it was kind of a reckoning. Yes, a little different.
I remember when this switch happened with Columbus Day.
Yeah.
And this felt the same where it was like people are like, not so much.
A little bit of bellwether.
It's not so much.
When it was, because I feel like, I mean, gosh, in my lifetime, there was a period where like if you deigned like, say anything anti-USA 4th of July, like on the 4th of July, it would be like, you'd be shouted out, oh, it's fucking un-American, how dare you, the 4th, I fought for the gun, dissent was almost, not impossible, but like that whole Bush during like the Iraq wars, like you just couldn't question President Bush, like that's un-American.
No,
like,
I remember when we were in Argentina and we had some friends from Argentina come to visit us for a while, and it was 4th of July and they were like, do people really have these parades? They really have the flags? And we're like, yes, it's true. It's not fake. It's not made up in the movies. And then on the 4th of July,
well, you got the whole
Terminator.
Story. No, it wasn't.
It was Terminator.
Transformers.
Oh, yeah, Transformers.
The good one, the second one.
Transformers 2 came out. And that's one where it's like, we're going to take the fight to them. Like that whole thing.
It was a little like xenophobic.
It was crazy.
Yeah, like rah-rah.
It was 4th of July.
It came out 4th of July weekend.
Yeah, we went to see the big theater and everybody was going ape shit. It was ridiculous.
Like IMAX 3D, like, and this individual, Lucia, I don't think had ever seen an IMAX movie. And she's like, is that the screen? And I was like, yeah. And she goes, wait, it gets bigger? Because like, the curtain came back out,
right?
You know, like the thing's the whole room, like five stories high. And it was 3D, and it had like some wicked 3D, you know, CGI. Like,
we're not talking about the movie. Anyways, so
we're leaving all pumped.
Like, whoa.
Full of Americanism.
America! So we're laughing in the car, the four of us, just like how funny it is and how, yeah, people here are so ridiculous. Like, America! And so we stopped at like our version of 7-Eleven, which is Wawa. I miss you, Wawa. And,
Sad ding.
And, we're getting out of the car and Drew's saying like, oh yeah, you know, people are really crazy. They were like, yeah, America! And shit you not, random dude also going into the Wawa turns and goes, yeah, America, like dead ass
in the air, like fuck
we
yeah
were joking, and like we just collapse in a puddle. But
America, fuck yeah.
So this year though, we did get to do two things here, some Grand Rapids area, East Grand Rapids. We marched in the East Grand Rapids 4th of July parade in support of a friend of ours who's running for city commissioner. And I won't say his name, so his chances aren't thwarted by our endorsement. And and
that's like the sign of the apocalypse. Like, you've been endorsed by Interracial John. Like, wah, wah, wah.
Exactly. And then we went to my BFF's house, which is on.
You just like yada 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 the whole parade business with the candy and that shit was weird, man. Like I grew up in like a seriously like a really white, it's like I we'll talk weird. Later about the town I grew up in that's like a sundown town, and I'm not saying that ECR like was or is a sundown town, but it's equally as non-black, right?
It's
like
super white,
like fraction of a percent, like 0.25% people of color.
Correct.
And on the 4th of July, they have a parade, and they got like the typical parade stuff, like dudes in old cars,
bagpipes, and fire department,
exactly.
Shit.
But so
and
all the,
of course,
all the
candidates,
all the politicians.
But see, now people know where the candidate was.
Well, it doesn't matter. So they're all out there, but the friggin' candy, like they're handing out candy.
Not everybody hands out candy.
Quite a few people do.
People do, and people hand out other stuff. Didn't you notice somebody was handing out ice pops?
Somebody did have the Freezy Pops.
So everybody had Freezy Pops.
Yeah, so anyway, people are handing out things, But like people that live there or around here, like they know the game.
It's like trick or treating,
dude. Trick or treating. Fuck, dude had like a lacrosse stick, like a net, like he's holding this like a defenseman's lacrosse stick with like a 4 foot reach.
Oh, but I did get the info on that. In years past, there it had turned into morphed into this like
three for all throwing candy,
throwing candy at people. There's rules. So they made a rule now: you can only like underhand throw a certain amount.
4 feet from the curb.
Away from yeah. whatever.
They gave us the rules. We read the rules.
Hilarious rules. To me.
Yeah. I'd be out there with the friggin', you had it down right, the pool skimmer.
Oh, yeah, just like, throw it here.
But they were like kids with like what you'd expect after a Halloween haul.
Yeah,
like
man.
A trick-or-treat haul.
Serious.
Like big
serious.
Pillowcase full of...
And it wasn't shitty candy either. It was all really good candy.
But for real, though?
White people.
And then we watched the fireworks, which was nice. But the best thing that happened on... July 4th was Cookout News Network on Black Twitter.
And I got to say, it was like a super white 4th of July, as we were talking about. And Black Twitter the rescue.
Black fucking Twitter. I really was dying. I was laughing so hard. It was so funny.
That's why they hired a correspondent, the LA Times. That's why they need a Black Twitter correspondent. Because shit like this, because Black Twitter's hilarious.
It was so funny. I just thought it was the most hilarious thing. So people started putting hashtags up of, you know, what happens. And the person that started it was a comedian, right? Sarome Russell, right?
I think he's part of the Decepticomics.
Yes, the Decepticomics. So shout out to you, Sarome, for starting this. It's awesome.
Cookout News. It might have been a play on CNN, Cookout News Network, CNN.
Oh, I'm sure I was.
It was, you know, that's not my lane. Very white guy. I don't.
So it was a mixture of like pictures and, you know, and then the words. And then some of them were just like people just saying, you know, whatever. So it was fucking hilarious and so, so, so funny. What were the ones that you liked?
I don't even have that up. Like I said, it's not my lane. I didn't retweet any of them at all.
Oh, you didn't retweet any of them?
No, see, because that's not the very white guy platform. Like, I'll laugh at it and I think it's funny, but I'm not going to be sharing that. Other than to say that Sarome was hilarious, and
just thought, I don't care who you are, you cannot like not laugh at these things because it was so funny. Your mama fuss at you looking slutty in front of people's husbands, but they your uncles. Hashtag Cookout News Network. Yeah,
that uncle you have to keep reminding all the women at the cookout are family.
Yes. Your uncle lecturing you about the Bible and your lifestyle, and that's not his wife? Hashtag Cookout News Network.
That untouched peach cobbler looked pretty. It's been sitting there for 7 hours. Don't eat it. Trust me.
Your cousin's new girlfriend has not offered to help once. She will be his ex-girlfriend by tomorrow afternoon.
There's a bunch using that Denzel meme, too.
Oh, yeah. Uncle Denzel.
Oh, for shit's sake.
Oh, yeah.
Hell
of a reason like,
just Cookout News Network / Uncle Denzel. Mm-hmm. Cracking my shit up.
Aunt Debbie finally works up the courage to ask why she's always asked to bring just beverages. Because she can't cook for shit, Aunt Debbie. Everybody knows this. When your uncle's white girlfriend asks, what's the difference between yams and sweet potatoes?
Mm-hmm. It was good. Mm-hmm. Definitely unwhited our 4th of July.
It did. It was great. It was just really
good,
funny.
Combatant to the whiteness. And we were sitting around waiting for the fireworks. Like, I don't know if there's anything like I would say that's boring, but like you're just sitting around waiting for fireworks. And Cookout News Network was very worthwhile.
Definitely. Your mom, now drunk, just yelled, "Who made these greens? I don't eat everybody cooking. And Tammy don't wash her hands."
And I can't remember which they were, but like honestly, like there was like a dozen or more. I read like, oh my god, that's my sister-in-law Karen. Like, oh my god, Denise has totally done that. Like, it was like, yes. it was funny. It was funny. So we do.
Your 12-year-old cousin wins the family twerking contest. 36-year-old runner-up Aunt May cusses about how she's fast.
Aunt May, the 12-year-old.
Oh god,
can't keep up with the twerk.
Your uncle in the all-white Air Force Ones is cheating at spades. That's the third time he had the Jack of Spades. So funny.
You know, and again, a little bit of like, you know, I resemble that. We were playing at a cookout with your nephew and his best buddy.
Yep.
And it was just like, I don't think so. Like, I've played plenty of spades. You don't get to, like, bid fucking 10 and do it, like, you know what I'm saying? There was some shady business. That's all I'm saying. Shady business. There was, like, there was a little bit too much, like, I'm not called, like, cheating communication. And it's not even really cheating. Like, if you know the spade, like, you and I, like, if we're playing spades together, like, I know how you play. I know, the, like, the way you count points and what you would think and, you know, whether you're aggressive or not. And, like, I can play that. Like, we have a little bit of, like, a symbiosis. We've been together for so long. But him and his boy, no, don't play spades with him at the cookout.
No. The cha-cha slide was commenced. Cousin Larry's still trying to get someone to loan him money to start his car wash. Oh, I'll just do a couple more. Keep your eye out. Aunt Janet done gave three of your homeboys her number already.
Oh. Mm-hmm. I had to do, I told you about that. A guy I went to college with. We're like, after college, we're like maybe 26, 27. And like, one of our friends started dating his mom. It was just super weird, man. And I'm not going to lie. Like, well, fun. Like, she was attractive for a 4-year-old, but it was like, damn, dude. Like, we were just hanging out and playing like Xbox. And he's going to go over here with your mom. Mm-hmm.
And my favorite one was, that's not your aunt's coworker. That's her girlfriend. She's just waiting on Big Mama to die to tell the family. So shout out to you, hashtag Cookout News Network. Kept our very white 4th of July blacker. So thank you for that.
Thank you, Russell.
If this is your first time watching or listening to the show, you can find us on iTunes or Stitcher Radio. Just search Interracial John, that's J-A-W-N, or go to our website, interracialjohn.com, or you can find us on iTunes or Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, Tumblr, all those things. Again, at Interracial John, J-A-W-N. We also absolutely love feedback, and we are on the Podfather and Pod Mistress, Mod and Karen's 5-star review plan. If you leave us a 5-star review on iTunes or Stitcher, we will read it on the air. You can also send us an email, interracialjohn@gmail.com, and you can leave us an up to 3-minute voicemail at 657-AJAWNERS. That's 657-JAWNERS. And I don't know what y'all are waiting for, but call and say something to us so we can interact with
you know, Carl, you're on every other month, but you could leave a voicemail too. You're the original Johnner. Start, break the seal, buddy. Leave that voicemail. That's all.
Yeah, dude.
All
right.
That was a long cold open.
Yeah, that's right. Let's get into it though.
The news is coming on. The news is coming on.
So, I don't know. Did this make it the same way through your purview as it did mine? In particular, everyone's favorite Facebook. The judge and the defendant that knew each other in middle school. Did you see that at all?
Yeah, I did see something about it. Actually, I saw Ejioma Olowu tweeting about it or Facebooking about it. I can't remember which.
Okay. It the way I saw it from a few different people was kind of like, I don't know. But I'll play the video clip here.
F15-13303. Okay, Mr. Booth, I have a question for you.
Yes, ma'am.
Did you go to Nautilus for middle school?
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness.
I'm sorry to see you there. I always wondered what happened to you, sir.
Oh, my goodness.
This is the nicest kid in middle school.
Oh, my goodness.
He was the best kid in middle school. I used to play football with him, all the kids. And look what has happened. I'm so sorry.
Oh, my goodness.
Mr. Booth, I hope you were able to change your ways. Good luck to you.
Oh, my goodness.
What's sad is how old we've become.
Oh, my goodness.
Good luck to you, sir. I hope you're able to come out of this okay and just lead a lawful life.
Man, what am I,
They'll explain to you how to take charge.
Okay.
And then it goes on. But, you know, just the way it was shared and some of the... just, you know, white knighting, white, you know, savior complex, and this whole, like, look at this, you know, people are together, and just, the whole thing rubbed me the wrong way. It just got presented, I felt like, I don't know, it just rubbed me the wrong way.
It rubbed me the wrong way, just in terms of, like, the stories, but I think the video itself, if the commentary is correct that goes with it, I think is really, can be really useful, because really the commentary should be that every black person is a human being. And this judge just realized that. And I would hope that every time she sees somebody sitting there that she thinks to herself, wow, that is probably somebody's really best cool guy that they went to middle school with. Like, just this idea of it, you know, I'm not talking about Bill Cosby at all, because fuck Bill Cosby, but you know, Jill Scott was a, you know, Cosby caper, and she issued some sort of ridiculous, you know, mea culpa kind of sort of, and somebody, because now there's proof. That's why I say kind of sort of. She said that, you know, now that there's proof, now she, you know, she was duped too, or something like that. So, you know, people came at her like, what are you talking about proof? You mean
40 women?
40 women saying that this happened to them wasn't enough. And I think the number's up to 47. But that don't make no sense. And she was like, blah, blah, blah. She was saying some stuff. So somebody said to her, what if it was your child that came to you and said that somebody had hurt them? Would you, you know, ignore them until you saw proof? And she was like, that's disgusting, vile, a filthy analogy to make. And I just tweeted back to her very simply, why? All of those women are somebody's child. Like, are you not seeing the hypocrisy in what you're saying? You're like, don't you say that anything could happen to my child. But you're perfectly fine with all of these women and how their mothers probably feel knowing that their child was raped and nobody even fucking believes them, including women who should be standing up for them.
And what's the form? Isn't that a form of apology where you don't really take ownership and acknowledgement?
Yes, that's the non-apology.
You know, you're just like, you know, facts are different and not, you know, I'm going to really sit and reflect on how I came to that fuck ass conclusion and why I thought that and why I said those things that I said and what it is about me that made me not believe those women until I saw this statement from a 2005.
Yeah. I mean, it's just ridiculous to say that there's no proof. It reminds me of this great movie, Tim's Vermeer. And if anybody hasn't seen the doc, I highly recommend it. But, he was saying, I just wish we had evidence, to kind of prove this theory he was putting forth about the painter Vermeer. And he's like, I wish we had evidence. And I said, and one of the other historians said, what are you talking about? You have evidence. You have the paintings. They are evidence. People treat it as though it's like news, written down documentation, but that this painting isn't perfect evidence for you to explore and understand exactly what happened. And it's the same way with this. It's like, I don't think that, I'm pretty sure those women testified under oath. They said it in front of judges. They brought lawsuits against this individual. I'm pretty certain that means that that's all proof of some sort.
Well, we've gone off from the judge and this defendant. The way the AP wrote it, it just...
No, but my point in... I was telling my analogy that I was saying to Jill Scott, like, she needed to see that these women were somebody's child. And I feel like I wish white people would understand that same thing. Because what it is that she sees a black person in her purview and they're not a human being. But she knew this one person.
Well, there's actually studies, like scientific evidence that white people, because of supremacy and anti-black conditioning... They struggle. They literally, the parts of the brain that parts of our brain that are active during empathetic activities. When I'm looking at somebody doing something, I'm like, oh, I'm having empathy. We literally do that less effectively when they're non-white people. White people don't empathize with non-white people as easily. It's like a fact. Like, there's science, like, okay, you can replicate this over and over and over again. Right. It's a form of almost implicit bias.
Right.
And you know, you and I have talked frequently about it sort of almost sucks. Like, you had your little bit, I won't say a rant, but you had your tweet-a-thon about white allies, and we don't need to get into it. That's going to be a better topic for FRN. But in part of that, you were saying that you don't trust a lot of white allies, and that, you know, even really good white allies, let's use Tim Wise as an example. I don't say he's a good white ally, but even, you know, let's just say, you know, high profile white allies.
Yeah.
There's oftentimes an air of, and Black Girl Maine had said this to me at one point as well, that there's kind of like this better than you condescending. And there's even a lot of, like, you know, ally industrial complex profiting off of, you know, writing books and so forth and so on, but not really doing anything to end supremacy.
Right.
And I think you and I both sort of said, if the individual, as a white person, as an anti-racist, that's, if they don't have, like, very close and deep personal relationships with people of color in their lives, it's almost like, I don't say, like, you said you don't trust them, I think you went that far.
Yeah.
But I think I wouldn't say I wouldn't trust the individual, but I think the ability to be clouded and lose vision on the eye of the prize and what the goal really is easy. You can be dissuaded from it easily if you don't have somebody in close relationship that you're, you know, is going to keep you honest and keep you check.
And I don't think that's going to be this case forever. I just think we haven't reached the point where that's not the case yet. If that makes any sense.
Yeah, I hear you
on that. I do feel like eventually there will come a point where it's like, yeah, nah. Like, we all need to be, like, pulling. I mean, it's, you know, that old adage of, like, on which side of history do you want to be on, you know? And we've seen plenty of times in history that something has had a shift. And I do feel it coming. I feel it different. I think it's not even close to that point yet, which is why my side-eye is so quick
well, and
to
I think,
go.
And but. I think, and I take a little bit different tack, too. I think you're right. And when I say not there, maybe in just the, like, general awareness of you know, the white community in terms of our race and whiteness and what, you know, all that entails in terms of doing this work. Because I think there are, I don't say, I know personally tons and tons of really good woke white people that are doing the work. And I don't know, I don't think they have, you know, black family members, spouses, kids, whatever. But they're still doing really great work. So I don't think they have to be, they're not like, one's not dependent on the other. You know what I'm saying? Like, you can still do the work and just fuck up and make mistakes and, you know, try to do better. You don't have to have personal relationship to do the work. And I think you're seeing that. I think you're seeing people like, you know, I want to lift a Black Lives Matter banner, but I don't know enough and I don't understand. And I know something's wrong. And I think Mike Brown shouldn't have been killed. And I don't know. I'm just going to hold this banner up. You know what I mean? Like, I think you're seeing that level of white people getting into the movement. And it's, like you said,
yeah,
there's growth needed.
You're getting into a whole different area about white people holding on Black Lives Matter signs. So let's move on to the next topic.
Speaking of more racist ass shit, but this is actually a good thing. Redskins, Daniel Snyder, he cannot trademark the name. So there's been a back and forth legal battle in different state and federal courts. But so the Washington Redskins football team lost a key battle in court on Wednesday over their trademark registration as a federal judge ruled to cancel the NFL team's registration, stating that the logo might denigrate Native Americans. The decision is a setback for the team's ongoing legal and public relations battle that's taken course over the past year, but a win for the Native American activists who opposed the logo, including five individuals who were faced with a lawsuit last summer, according to the Washington Post. The cancellation will not officially take place until the team has exhausted all appeals in federal courts. But it's still another a peg in the right direction, to because if they can't trademark the name, it's unlikely that he's going to keep it.
Of course not. I mean, that's crazy. I
you,
mean,
you wouldn't,
my
you wouldn't
thing
put
is
money
like,
into a
I would just start making shit with Redskins. That's like the worst with Redskin logos. That's like the worst shit. Like diuretic and adult diapers. And
that would be your protest.
Rat poison. And like literally,
that's not better
Drano.
For Native Americans. Though.
No, but I'm saying it would mean like all of this horrible stuff with that logo because that's what it should. That it's so ridiculous. I'm not saying it's better for Native Americans. I was just saying that like if because the point of it is that other people can use it. And I was thinking like if you use it really shittily,
I was thinking the other way. You could like, and I imagine you have some protection. Like I was thinking like all of a sudden you see dudes like the T-shirts in the parking lot. Times like a billion. Like, get your Redskins jersey here for
$2.
But
I don't think that hurts him, though. Like, the thing is to make it be, like, associated with crappy things. Because it's ridiculous and it's a slur. I mean, for real. I'm just saying, like, you say it wouldn't help Native Americans. But, like, I'm just saying that, like, none of them, no Native American or First Nations individual would ever want to be called a Redskin.
No.
So to me, it makes more sense to put it on Drano and, you know, rat poison and because it's a slur. I mean, it's disgusting.
Well, and the number of professional and collegiate sport teams that are named after First Nations, just in general, not all of them slurs, right. But just the number of sports teams, it's kind of, I don't say bizarre, but you don't see that with any, you know, there's like, I guess there's a couple Irish this team or that, but I don't know. There's not many other groups of individuals, in particular a marginalized group, where their names are sports teams.
It's very strange.
Like many, 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 many. Like the Florida Seminoles.
The Braves.
Illini, the Braves.
The Blackhawks.
Oh, there's tons.
So many. But the other ones aren't slurs, I don't think.
True, true.
So I'll say that. But I do think it's interesting that we have our very many different states discussing the Confederate flag, and yet this fucking sports team will give up a logo that's completely offensive to so many people. So it's just weird to me.
It's terrible.
Yeah. And other DVM or whatever they call that area news, Baltimore mayor fires police chief in wake of the Gray case and spike in violence. Mayor embattled, I'm going to put that in there because this bitch is embattled. Embattled Baltimore Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake said Wednesday that she has fired Police Commissioner Anthony Batts 2.5 months after riots broke out in the city following the death of a man who was injured in police custody. Really, WAPO, a man?
That's like so passive. When they broke his fucking neck. The murder
of Freddie Gray by the Baltimore Police Department. I'll fix that for you. Associated Press. The mayor said at a news conference Wednesday shortly after announcing her decision in a 3-paragraph news release that Batts' presence had become too much of a distraction from fighting the city's recent increase in violence. Quote, as we have seen in recent weeks, too many continue to die on our streets, including 3 just last night and 1 lost earlier today. Families are tired of feeling this pain, and so am I. Recent events have placed an intense focus on our police leadership, distracting many. It's clear that the focus has been too much on leadership of the department and not enough on the crime fight.
How about not enough on fucking holding cops that sever spines accountable? How about not severing spines?
Yeah.
How about that? Can we not do that?
How about we do that?
How about you do that?
Yeah.
Why can't you do that?
Why don't you do that? We'll see how long she lasts in office.
So who, have they replaced the...
Yeah, some interim dude. It's not even worth discussing because it's like Baltimore.
And he was a black dude, right? The commissioner?
Yeah. I mean, and I had this discussion with just some dumbass white person yesterday that were like, you shouldn't go after black leadership. I'm like, fuck you and your black fucking leadership. If they're running racist ass supremacist based systems, then the shit that they're doing is fucking racist. Study after study has shown that it does not matter who... what the race is of the police officer or the mayor or the commissioner or anybody when it comes to the way black people are treated by our law enforcement agencies.
Half the arrested officers in Freddie Gray's case were black. The most serious charge was a black guy. The guy that hid and falsified the report with Walter Scott on the planting a weapon, black dude.
Yeah.
I'm not trying to like call out black people.
No, you don't have to. The point is we're calling out everybody that's involved in it, but it's like the system is racist. Therefore, anybody who is participating in it is participating in a racist system. That's just a fact. But let's do some palate cleansing because I can't.
Please.
Yo, B, they ready. Let's go.
Feeling myself. I'm feeling myself. I'm feeling my, feeling myself. I'm feeling myself. I'm feeling my, feeling my, feeling myself. I'm feeling myself. I'm feeling my, feeling myself. I'm feeling myself. I'm feeling my.
I want some hood girls looking back at it and a good girl in my tax bracket. Got a black card and let sex have it. These Chanel bags is a bad habit. I do balls, down Mavericks. My Maybach, black matted. Bitch never left, but I'm back at it. And I'm feeling myself, Jack Rabbit. Feeling myself, back off. Cause I'm feeling myself, Jack off. Think about me when he wax off, wax on, that national anthem hats off, then I curve that nigga like a bad horse, let me get a number 2 with some Mac sauce, or on a run tour with my mask off.
I'm feeling myself, I'm feeling myself, I'm feeling my, feeling myself, I'm feeling myself, I'm feeling my, feeling my.
So, this week on Dope Black Girls, thank you to Beyonce and Nicki Minaj for giving us a little theme song for this. Black woman artist poses nude at former New York City slave trading sites, including the World Trade Center. Artist Nona Faustine wanted to call attention to the history and enduring legacy of the slave trade in New York City. I'll have a quote from her here. As a time traveler, I'm very invested in the past and our future. I see myself, the people who built this city and the country, as one. They deserve so much recognition for their sacrifice and contributions, something that is still being denied them. There was a deep force inside of me that needed to pay homage to those who played a pivotal role in the early history of this city and the spaces in which they existed. I wanted to uncover those places where a tangible link to the past exists. Being a documentarian at heart, I wanted you to feel and see those spaces. Let your mind wander. What does a black body look like today in the place where they sold human beings 250 years ago? No other medium but photography and film could do that.
I don't, the pictures were powerful. She's wearing white pumps, like white shoes.
White shoes.
And she's at, you know, all these various locations. And I think a lot of times, too, I don't say people forget, but that's part of that whitewashing. And even in some of the narrative and rhetoric you hear now, it's like, oh, you know, South and Confederate. There's not like, no. There are plenty of slaves up north, too. And, you know, there were slave trading blocks in Chicago and New York and all over the place. Don't get it twisted.
Absolutely. She says that her white shoes represent the white patriarchy that we cannot escape, by the way, just so you know why she's wearing that in each of the photos. The photo series was inspired by Saarchi Sarah Bartman, known as the Venus Hottentot, a Koki African woman whose large buttocks and curvy figure were exhibited in a freak show throughout 19th century Europe. Period.
Nice.
And so just, I thought it's just really amazing to see her. She was on Wall Street. Slavery was introduced to Manhattan, then New Amsterdam in 1626, and for two centuries remained a significant part of New York life. In fact, the New York City Common Council declared Wall Street the city's first official slave market on December 13th, 1711, deeming it a space where human beings could be enslaved for the day or for the week. The slave market took the shape of a wooden structure with open sides and held approximately 50 people at a time. It operated as such on the corner of Wall Street and Pearl Street in the heart of the financial district until 1762. Slavery was legally abolished in New York in 1827.
Yeah. And you think Wall Street, too, just the birth of, yep, you know, all that money and finance. And what was one of the first commodities that they had down there, literally in a like stock and pen, black bodies.
Yeah. So shout out.
That's America.
Shout out to you, dope black girl. Nona Faustine. She's awesome. And we'll have a link to all the information about her, but it's just really fucking awesome. Brilliant and awesome. So
you did this last week, dope black girls. You have more dope? Is that the only one?
I just did this one this year, okay, because I just thought it was so cool. And the photos themselves, they do have some.
Nona's a tremendous photographer, yeah, obviously.
So yeah. I just thought
the composition, the lighting,
everything about it was just so good.
So
good.
You did dope black girls last week.
Yeah.
And as you were doing it, I was thinking to myself, you know, I got to bring something to the table production wise. Uh-huh. So I'm going to bring the inverse.
Okay.
Dumb as fuck white men.
That's easy.
A lot of material. But this week, I'm just going to let the audio play because this says it all.
Okay, great.
I'm a bystander and, again, made the ill-considered decision to go into the water here. We understand that he made preparations to go into the water, removed his shirt, removed his billfold, and, again, someone shouted a warning, and he said, blank the alligators, and thereupon jumped into the water and was almost immediately yelled for help. The signs are posted, and one is there underneath a light, warning no swimming, alligators.
And I asked him, please do not go swimming. There's a bigger alligator out here. Just please stay out of the water. And the next thing I know, this girl is screaming, an alligator's got him. And I grab a flashlight, trying to zoom it over the water, trying to find him. And next thing I know, I saw his body floating face down. And then he's up there for a couple seconds. And then he gets dragged back down and pulled off. And then he comes back up, still face down. And then he gets pulled down again, and then he just disappears, and I couldn't see him after that, and I kept trying to figure out and calling his name and and he was dead.
And this is a horrible video.
The woman that's talking is the woman that witnessed it. She's not the
obviously
friend of the genius that did this. Fuck them gators. And that's, almost immediately screamed for help, a gator's got me. Fuck them gators.
Lord have mercy.
And the signs everywhere. She, this is the woman says, and I think the trauma for her. She goes, don't go in there, please. There's a gator. Then she has to see you get like kind of eaten.
What is wrong with these people?
That just, honestly, there's like that Darwin Awards, right? Where people like, you know, die in just like dumber than dumb situations. And that one's got to be, it's just, I don't know what. He's dead. So it's like, what were you thinking? I don't know. He's dead. But so speaking of dumb as fuck white men and our new segment, which there's, again, a lot of material for.
It's a GOP clown car.
Again, my man Donald Trump. He's rolling, dude. He's on fleek with his stupidness. But so... First of all, he got dumped by Macy's, then he got dumped by NBC. He's getting, you know, all kinds of flack. And this is a Twitter war from, I think, 2 years ago that he had with the head writer and executive producer of Modern Family. And just maybe if you're going to go into a Twitter war, I wouldn't do it with a writer of a top comedy show, Danny Zucker. Zucker tweeted him a picture and said, you've always been tough on China, sir. Particularly the children who make your shitty clothes. And he had pictures of all this like Donald Trump signature collection with tags made in China, right? So Trump comes back with, Danny, you're a total loser. That's it. That's his retort.
That's the whole retort.
Yeah. Danny, you're a total loser. You know, like, I believe he's actually at the controls. There's nobody, if he had somebody tweeting for him, that wouldn't be better than that. He says, your insult need work. Here's one I've been working on. Every picture you post of yourself is a dick pic. See? Trump, I can't resist hitting lightweight Danny Zucker verbally when he starts up because he's just so pathetic and easy. Stupid. Danny Zucker writes back, since you're unable to manufacture decent comebacks, maybe you could outsource the job to China. LOL. Trumpelstiltskin.
Trumpelstiltskin.
Hashtag Trumpelstiltskin. That's kind of where it gets me. Lightweight Danny Zucker is too stupid to see that China and others are just is destroying the U.S. economically and our leaders are helpless. Sad. Danny Zucker writes back, I'm definitely too stupid to see how manufacturing your shitty clothes in China while you bloviate about them isn't hypocritical. So, Trump's going to keep on coming. Just tried watching Modern Family, written by a moron. Really boring. Writer has the mind of a very dumb and backward child. Sorry, Danny. Danny writes back, Donald Trump doesn't like the show. Donald Trump doesn't like the show I work on. But then we've never tested well with the racist, hypocritical, multi-bankruptcy demo.
Wow.
And so Trump keeps going back. Who on earth is Danny Zucker? A lightweight moron who only gets attention by attacking Trump. So Danny keeps going back. Clearly the one thing Donald Trump didn't inherit from his daddy was a thesaurus. Hashtag loser, hashtag dummy, hashtag lightweight. So then he writes, bye for now, Donald. I have a busy night of not grandstanding to put the wrong people to death in the Central Park mugging case. And Donald apparently didn't write back. And this is like 2 years ago, but it's obviously going viral now because he's, you know, running for president. He's a total fucking gas bag douchebag. But shout out to Danny Zucker for making Trumpelstiltskin.
Making it happen.
That's my new one from now on, Trumpelstiltskin. Yeah. He just keeps going and going. And he keeps fucking raising the polls, but neither here nor there. He was on Anderson Cooper, and Anderson Cooper was talking to him about his own workforce, and Trump literally admitted that he can't guarantee the legal status of his own workers, but then did say if any of them are legal, he's going to fire them right away. So all his rhetoric, all his fucking horse shit, he can't even... You know, but if I find anybody, I'll fire him right away. But just fuck that dude, because he sucks. We should go on to something much, much better. Am I black enough for you?
Am I black enough for you? So, Obese, getting it done. Just like, seriously... I don't know. I keep thinking this is as, you know, on fleek as he's going to get. And then he's right. Like, fuck you. I'm doing some more. So today he commuted nonviolent drug sentences to reduce mass incarceration.
That gets like so many dings.
Yep. In a recent effort to cut back the number of people incarcerated on nonviolent drug offenses. President Barack Obama says he will free dozens more federal prisoners in the next weeks, according to the New York Times. Obama is planning on starting with sentences of around 80 individuals who have been locked up on nonviolent drug offenses, but that's just a start. There are over 30,000 prisoners who have applied for clemency, and there is talk emanating from the White House that these 80 are just the first wave. The Obama administration claims that this is all part of a broader move to correct judicial abuse, discrimination, and general over-sentencing. The Raw Star reports that the American Civil Liberties Union statistics reveal the United States has the largest prison population in the world.
Oh my God, it's not just in the world. It's while
the nation only has 5% of the total global population, it houses a full 25% of the world's imprisoned. That's a 700% increase since 1970, despite the fact that during that same time period, crime has decreased. Without question, the massive escalation of caging nonviolent offenders is due to the so-called war on drugs, now widely seen as an abject failure, and this has been linked to this massive increasing incarceration rate. And in the book, The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration, Age of Colorblindness, they don't even put Michelle Alexander's name in this piece. Man, fuck y'all. In the book, I'll have to correct this too. In the book, Picture The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration, and the Age of Colorblindness, written by Michelle Alexander, highlights the crossover with systemic racism, noting that there is currently more imprisoned African Americans today than there were slavery at the height of the institution in 1850.
I say that shit all the time.
And, so, yeah.
You know, I'd love to see this lame duck blackness with
seriously,
this.
Seriously, they didn't even credit her from, it's her fucking book. Yeah, they're quoting. That's crazy. It's disgusting.
So, back to Obama. If he were to pull the trigger on, like all 30,000, or even just, like, half of that 30,000, that would be so unbelievable. Just amazing. Just, like, think of all the fucking, I was literally just reading about Arnold Schwarzenegger, who, in his final days, like the last, like usually there's pardons and then there's like, okay, it's the last day. It's like January 19th where, you know, the inauguration is tomorrow. I'm no longer president like in 6 hours. I'm going to pardon some fucked up shit, right? Like you see that. Bill Clinton did it. He got one of his Whitewater lawyers. He pardoned. Like people get, you know, they do that shit. I get it. But Schwarzenegger pardoned a individual that was the son of a really high ranking Democrat. Nunez, I think was his name. Uh-huh. And he was part of they went out, like, going, you know, to be aggressive and do things and ended up stabbing somebody in the heart and killing them, right? Like, whoa. Stabbed an individual and basically should have got life, but ended up getting, like, you know, a very small commuted sentence. And then Schwarzenegger reduced it to even less. And he's going to be able to get out, or he's going to get out, like, next year, like, serves maybe 18 months for killing an individual. And he did that his last moments before leaving. But this is very, very, very different. This isn't like political friends.
No, it's
allies.
Not. This is policy statements. Clemency.
Yeah. This
completely different.
That office and that pardon process is meant for. And I would just love for some fucking these people that are talking like Obama doesn't do enough of this and Obama doesn't do enough of that. You know, not, you know me, I'm not talking about, like, you know, intra-community black dialogue. But in particular, I've seen some people say, like, you know, this narrative that Obama hasn't done enough for black America, right? Like, he's pardoning these individuals. Absolutely guarantee you the vast majority of them, based on criminal justice statistics, are going to be black and have been in jail for nonviolent, simply possession, for languishing for forever. Those sentences from the 80s and the 90s, oh, crazy. On crack, like the amount of crack that gets you like a 7-year mandatory minimum sentence, it's I don't want to call it unfathomable, but at one point it was 100 to 1, the cocaine difference. 100 to 1. Why is that? And when it's 100 to 1, the sentencing discrepancy is 100 to 1, you're going to get individuals in jail for just, you know, huge, huge fucking stretches. For, you don't even see people do that long for violent, you know, crimes that end up with homicide. They get out sooner than somebody did based on a mandatory minimum on a quantity of a drug. It's horrible. And it's good. I'm thrilled that he's doing it. And he's doing it early. He's on the pardon train
now.
Yeah,
man, he's starting this shit now.
Fucking love it, dude.
Because he got 30,000 people to let out, so he got to get to going.
Yeah, I'll give him a second. I'm black, I'm black, I'm black. Yeah.
Okay.
He got the horn too.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm into these subscription boxes.
I love a subscription.
I know
box.
You do too, but I love the model. Like to me, like
oh, just,
like,
just the idea. Yeah, just I like the, getting the, stuff. The, well, and
as a business, there's so much that's moving to like subscription model, where it's just like, you know, pay as you go, month to month, so forth and so on. So there's now, if you can fucking believe it, a pot box, a monthly subscription box for dank weed.
What?
And I thought maybe like only in Colorado, maybe Washington, D.C. There may actually be no reason to leave your home again, says this reporter. At this point, it may be easier to count things that don't have a subscription-based service behind it. And although Potbox may not be the first marijuana subscription box, it's certainly the fanciest we've seen. There's more than one. So inside the marijuana farm, so this is in Colorado that grows the weed. Potbox is launching a California-based monthly subscription box that delivers the highest quality and most ethically sourced and grown cannabis right to your door.
Ethically sourced.
However, because marijuana is not legal recreationally, state subscribers must be registered medical marijuana patients, which we hear is about as hard as buying a bottle of cough syrup. The company's rolling out in San Francisco and is testing out in some areas of L.A. The only one package, $149.95 for a quarter ounce of two types of weed. So that's $150 for a half ounce of weed, $300 an ounce. Is that market price? I guess it's really good weed. That's right. Like, it seems like a lot, but anyway, $150 for a quarter ounce of two types of weed, as well as two hand rolled joints. The company plans on adding additional pricing, delivery, and product options. Representative for the company told Mashable that their bags are heavier than most, weighing in at 8 grams per quarter ounce and about a gram for each joint, totaling 10 grams of pot per package.
So, is this in California?
Yeah.
So I thought in California, like, it was only, like, you have to have a car. Isn't it medical only there, or did something happen and I missed it?
It is medical, but they just said it's apparently stupid easy.
You know, I get that, but how are they getting, how can they mail it to anybody?
Wait a minute. I'm sorry. Like, you stopped me. You know, I didn't finish reading the article. I said, like, is that a lie? I guess I don't know. In the rest of the, according to Price of Weed website, the average cost of an ounce of weed in the state of California is $241, but that includes the black market and may not be delivered to your door. Marvina, a similar subscription box for cannabis, costs $95 for a quarter ounce of weed delivered. That's 7 grams.
Interesting.
Potbox prides itself on quality and ethically produced cannabis.
Well, you know, they got a box for everything else. Why not cannabis?
You can't get a box for fucking everything, but that's weed, true. That's nutty.
Well, times, they are changing.
They are changing.
Well, I saw this really cool video. I actually just wanted to play it because we're always talking about, like, media bullshit and how, you know, just this portrayal of
funny
black...
how the media covers white riots versus...
What's up? About how the media covers black people versus funny how white people. And it's the same... you know, just you would expect that only black people do crime if you watch the news every night. Like, that would be your takeaway, that, like, black people equal crime and white people, nothing bad. They never right. do anything bad ever.
And again, that's been the Color Lines, the Race Forward group, did a research of tens of thousands of hours, and black individuals are overrepresented by, like, 30% versus the amount of actual crime.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So, well, we'll just listen to this little quick report.
Covers white riots versus black protests. Seems like when the protesters are black, the media uses some pretty harsh words.
The bad guys.
Lawlessness. Looting.
Wild animals.
Criminals. And thugs.
Thugs. Isn't it the right word?
However, if you're white and you're tearing up the city because of a game, you're just young people.
Young people danced on a flipped over car
as UK fans did stupid things.
Some maybe got a little out of control.
Seeing a scene like this just shows how passionate the UK fans are.
It's so tough to lose, and unfortunately the ugly side that we sometimes see in sports.
And notice how the police always show up to a black protest in military-grade equipment, and yet the media claims they're just doing nothing.
It's inexplicable why the police are doing nothing.
Let's mobilize the National Guard.
If I'm a rioter and I see the police doing nothing, I might feel like I have a license.
You would.
But at white riots, the cops actually are standing around doing nothing.
Another group of cops over there just standing there.
No one was really doing anything.
These guys look like they could be watching a parade. And why is it that the leadership of the black community is always called into question?
Where is the leadership?
Leadership.
The black leadership.
The absence of leadership.
And it goes back to leadership, but that leadership has to come from the community.
But no one ever questions the leadership of white parents who let their kids burn down and vandalize their college campus.
These are just young college students who think they're playing some kind of a game with police officers.
No, sometimes they don't even call a white riot a riot.
Party gone awry.
Some fans got a bit too rowdy after the win.
A dispute. A bloody brawl.
There was some type of altercation.
Waco? 170 arrested, 9 people dead.
They're not thugs.
Baltimore, no deaths, but it's a riot, chock full of thugs.
Thugs.
Just thugs.
What if the media portrayed white rioters the same as black protesters? Let's switch the audio and see how it plays out.
Breaking news, violent protest.
What you're looking at is the unraveling of the civil society.
Criminals. I'm like, because you can't see the images, but you get the idea.
Yeah.
You get the idea.
That motorcycle fight in Waco, it was, we didn't have to talk about it. It was just crazy. The language and the downplaying. Everyone you just showed, those clips, all of them were just, makes me so mad.
Mm-hmm. Can't help but be mad.
Yeah, I guess it's aggravating. Mm-hmm. I just enter the language, and people don't, I don't say they don't get it, but you know what? I think when they don't get it and you allow that to just sort of like be absorbed and seep in, and you and I talked a little bit about, you know,
funny how the
calling
media
out
white riots versus black.
Sorry, I don't know why that just opened again.
Let's say the media's language and framing of the events when the individuals are white versus black is problematic. We all know it. It's obvious. It's clear as day. But when you call it out, when you say, like, "Hey, this is problematic, and this is why it's problematic," now all of a sudden you're the race baiter, and you're bringing up race all the time, and you know why are you saying this and making people feel bad, but. You know, you kind of have to call it out, especially on the media side. And I don't know what the answer is, but it's a constant barrage of, you know, not even subtle, just over the top, overt anti-blackness. And you know, I don't say like, how do you not absorb it? How do you not absorb that?
No, I mean, you do absorb it.
How do you not absorb that? And I'm not, you know, I'm talking all people.
Yeah,
you know,
all people.
You get, you know, when they talk about the leadership, I'm surprised they did it in the video because it almost always goes to, where are black fathers? Where are the fathers? You know, let's talk about this. Let's talk about
that. I won't even go into that fallacy because it's a total crock of shit also. Because statistically, black fathers are more involved with their children than white ones. But that's a whole different story for a different day.
Very good. Did you know, we lived in Philly. We've left. And I just saw an article on NPR about murals and what right artists have to the product of the buildings that they paint on. And so Philadelphia, if people don't know, is actually named Mural City. And they have a wonderful mural arts program where I think it started with graffiti artists when they got, arrested or caught. Rather than fining them, they had them paint murals. And now there's thousands of murals all over the city. But so in talking about murals and what value they have. There was an individual who painted in, I think it was Detroit, called the Illuminated Mural. It was the emblematic of Detroit's North End. And it's on the auction block. They're selling the building. And there's some disagreement as to what rights he has. And there's an act, the Visual Artist Rights Act of 1990. And there was an individual, mural of Ed Rucha in Los Angeles had been painted over in June 2006 by the federal government. And he had worked on it for 9 years. And they painted over it one day. And it's this beautiful mural. And I was like, why would somebody paint over this, you know, gorgeous 7-story building mural? And he took the government to court, and he won $1 million. So now there's this VARA, Visual Artist Rights Act. So there's some discrepancy as to kind of what, you know, right now the act says you have to give 90 days. But it's kind of interesting that, you know, Detroit, this building is for sale, and it's got this famous mural. And, you know, to the artist, does he own it? Does he have some sort of stake in it? I don't know.
Yeah, definitely. I had gone on that Philly Mural Arts program, and it was kind of this VIP thing, and the person that actually led the mural tour was Jane Golden, who's the executive director of the City of Philadelphia's Mural Arts Program, one of the most renowned mural arts programs in the entire world. Like, people come from all over to learn about how Philadelphia runs its mural program. So she was a young artist who was initially hired by former Mayor Wilson Good to help combat the graffiti crisis plaguing the city. And so she helped kind of, as Drew mentioned, turn graffiti into art that would be showcased throughout the city.
Right.
And so, you know, it's now this huge thing. And I actually talked to her about this question, you know, because they have a few pieces that she was like, that's not going to be there anymore because it's, you know, that building's getting torn down or the people building in the lot next to it will be covering it up and stuff like that. And I was like, how do you handle it? She's like, you know, there's a few ways that they end up going about it, at least in Philadelphia. One way is you hope that the new owners want to keep the mural. And so you would go in and touch it. Sometimes you're able to move it. And they have new techniques, especially newer, you know, or they'll try and recreate it in another space.
Right.
But more and more, they're just starting to not go into new mural situations that are not conceived as such. So they are part of the city landscape, but it's like, say, you know, the side of one of the bridges that goes over the Schuylkill. That's a space that they know is going to be kept as a mural space because of what it is. Or if a new building is going up, the mural would be incorporated into the building of that.
And so the woman that was you're talking about talked about some compromise that has to be made sometimes.
Absolutely.
And you can't fight, you know, part of a mural. You know, buildings are temporary. They're not going to last forever. Yep. And things change. And in fact, right now, the city of Philadelphia is struggling, grappling with what to do with East Coast humpbacks. You know, the big humpback whales?
Yep.
When you come right under the market, that block that's empty is a parking lot, and they're renovating it this month. And they don't know what they're going to do with it. So that
yeah.
all these
decisions
are talking about.
I mean, definitely. But she says sometimes you just lose them. You know, she has come to realize in her work that, just what she said to me, that murals are not temporary pieces of art. They are long-term. And you may have them.
You said they're not temporary?
They are temporary.
They are temporary. Okay.
That they are not meant to be permanent.
Right.
The medium itself is not a permanent medium. And so she always makes sure the artists she works with understand that it could be here for 10 years. It could be here for 50 years. But in truth, because of where you are, it's going to end up not being there eventually. Yeah. And I understand the argument of the artist, but I also would say that at some point in the future, it's not a canvas. You're not going to get to bequeath it to somebody.
But imagine coming underneath to go into the Reading Terminal Market and coming
not
out
seeing
under,
the whales.
And not seeing the
I
whales.
Know.
Like,
it
that's kind of weird.
It's going to be very strange. And I think for cities, it becomes, you know, a little more tricky, especially when they start to, you know, like you said, they become iconic. So,
yeah. I'm not surprised because it's across from a parking lot. Like, and you're going to, that's space, it's valuable,
right.
It's real estate, it's going to get developed at some point. But it'll be weird to not have that. Visual. I wonder if the new building that goes there, it'd be stupid to make that a mural space because that's facing, I think, Market Street. It's going to be windows, most likely, like retail
sure
on the bottom.
Yeah, it'll probably be windows.
It'd be good to do. They should do some sort of homage. They should do something.
They could. They could do. I'm sure they'll try. They're talking
When we find out someone's in Philly, when you figure out what's happening, let us know. We can give
an
update.
Yeah, for sure. So I want to give a shout out to my sister and Shiro, Linda Sarsour, along with quite a lot of other people. This is from an article in HuffPost, how American Muslims are helping black churches rebuild after a spate of fires. Muslims are bringing hope to Christian communities in the South after a recent spate of fires, some arson, devastated black church buildings. Three Muslim organizations have teamed up to raise money to rebuild worship centers in Florida, Tennessee, North Carolina, and South Carolina that were destroyed. The, quote, Respond with Love campaign, organized by the Muslim American Muslim Anti-Racism Collaborative, the Arab American Association of New York, and Umawide during the holy month of Ramadan has already raised close to $25,000 with the help of more than 500 individual supporters. And I just know I heard about this because of Linda. She posted the first night that it was open that she was not going to sleep until they hit $10,000, and she was not playing. She was like on the phones hitting specific people to get donations. And so Linda Sarsour, executive director of the Arab American Association of New York, told HuffPost that she doesn't believe that these fires can be discussed without remembering periods in history when black churches were the targets of arson. Quote, It doesn't matter to us how or why these churches burned down. We want to help our black sisters and brothers get back in their houses of worship as soon as they can. Ramadan is a time of giving, and what better cause to give to than one that rebuilds houses of worship where God's name is constantly called, remembered, and loved. Sarsour said organizers will be looking at ways to distribute the funds that will have maximum impact, providing relief for some churches on the list that don't have adequate insurance. The campaign will stay open until July 18th, around that time that Ramadan is expected to end.
And we'll have the link in our show notes.
Of course.
But I'll say this too. There are multiple campaigns of giving to support these seven churches?
Eight? I think it's eight.
Eight churches, my gosh. Forgive me for not knowing that. Eight churches that burned down. And
they didn't all burn down. They just had fire, to be clear.
Thank you. but there were multiple campaigns, and I shared one that was shared with me through that Surge group. I shouldn't say Surge group, through Surge. And it was through, I think, Move On, and it was like the giving branch of Move On. And a couple of people pointed out some troublesome language in it. Like, it wasn't really clear where the money was going. It wasn't necessarily a 501c. And I had kind of thought, like, Move On. Like, I assume they're pretty good, but I don't know what their percent they dropped to the bottom line. And then I talked to you, and you said, oh, you know, you should share the one that Linda's got. And, of course, I love Linda, and she's amazing. And I said, after I looked at it and looked at the other one for Move On, I said, you're right. These are problematic. I'm wrong. Go here, give to the one that Linda started, simply because I know her personally and I trust her implicitly.
Yeah,
and,
for
and
sure.
There's no other explanation than I don't need to.
I did need, somebody asked me the same thing, and I was like, nope, I don't know about anything about that one, but this one I know 100%.
Yeah.
It's going to the right place, and it will get to the people it's supposed to get to. So use this one instead. So I've been sharing it just exactly the same way. Anytime anybody asks me, I'm like, I can't speak ill or not ill of any of the other ones, but this one I know for sure that I stand by and that John stands by. So we will be putting that link out for people to join the campaign and help these wonderful Muslims that are coming together to help rebuild these churches. The Respond with Love campaign.
Very nice. Mm-hmm. Very nice. Do you want to talk about this? You want to go right into slang? What do you want to do? What are we doing on the clock here? Are we running long? We about an hour?
Not, we're about an hour right now, so we're okay.
I guess let's talk about sundown towns. Yeah, let's keep it going. So there was an article, Rewinding Black, talking about current day sundown towns and racism in modern America. So for listeners that may or may not know, this very white guy grew up in a sundown town. Only about 0.25% people of color are black, I should say. But sundown towns are not part of America's discourse on race relations, despite the fact that they form a foundational aspect of it. Seems that our linear historical narrative of American history has confined racism in America to the Deep South and the years of Jim Crow laws. In short, we have come to think that racism is confined mostly to Confederate flag-waving Southerners, and even more disturbing, that it's a problem we've managed to largely fix. Of course, the story is far more complicated, and it turns out that these towns, sundown towns, played and still do play a major role in how African Americans are treated. What is a sundown town? They were, or rather are, small, all-white towns in which African Americans were banned from residing. In fact, any inauspicious person of color who found him or herself in these racially hermetic communities could face harassment, violence, or death. The name Sundown Town comes from the signpost on a city limit that read, "Whites only after dark," or some variation of the like. Usually, I always heard it as N-word, don't let the sun down go down on you in this town, mm-hmm. Literally. But so these towns are still around, and the vestiges of them haven't changed. And I even saw Rod from the Black Eye Identity tweet this or talk about it. Like, you know, we can be colorblind all we want, but until you start living in non-segregated communities and making different decisions, it's like, you're really not, you know what I'm saying? Like, in particular, white people, like, oh, I don't see color, and I have my one black friend, but I choose to live in a white community, and I choose to work and send my kids to an all-white school and segregate ourselves online in every other way. And I can't believe there's a race problem.
Mm-hmm. Sundown towns have been around since 1890, and between then and 1930, even through 1950s, they began sprawling through the West and Midwest, according to the book Sundown Towns by James Loden. Places like Elwood, Indiana had African Americans physically threatened, even in 2002. Since the last century and through today, Elwood has a zero, let me just say that again, zero black population and hosts an annual Ku Klux Klan parade. In fact,
I'm not saying like one goes with the other, but like, I please don't, if you're black, move to this
Elwood,
town,
Indiana.
Elwood, Indiana.
Yeah.
We don't need to change. You don't need to be like the Jackie Robinson of Elwood, Indiana. That can stay KKK white.
In fact, the, quote, progressive village of Oak Park, Illinois, now heralded as a modern image of racial harmony and inclusion for its middle to upper income residents, was once considered a sundown town by virtue of its negligible minority population as recent as the 1960s. As a matter of fact, the state of Illinois itself has one of the largest sundown town populations. It is estimated that about 145 exist today.
And the town I grew up in, they don't have visual evidence. So there's a a list of sundown towns. And if you go to the list, they have all the different towns and you can click on it. And then they'll say, here's the evidence that this is a sundown town.
Right.
And sometimes it's photographs, signs, whatever, whatever. At mine, it's just rumored, but everyone talked about it.
This description of it's a sundown town is an area that used to have African Americans banned from residing there and have continued to be devoid of black people.
Right.
There's no black people there.
The evidence you have is the lack of black people.
Yes.
But so the town I grew up in, it was really bad. Like there was a grocery store that I worked at, was a manager there for a period of time. And we employed quite a few people of color and frequently from Evanston or North Chicago. And they'd come via bus or train. And there were Sundays and other days where those conveyances didn't work. Public transportation wasn't running as it should on Sunday at later hours. So we had a van and we would, you know, as part of, okay, we need to employ these individuals. Let's, you know, we have a van. We'll take you to the train station. And I can't tell you the number of times the van got pulled over because of too many black people through a sundown town. And the van was a reason. It was like, okay, the six cops in this little town now know this green van from this grocery store full of black people on Sunday. That's a thing now. So we're gonna stop pulling it over. But those same individuals driving through town, no, forget about it. I had a friend Ed, he's like, no, I won't do it. You know?
Of course not. He ain't stupid.
No.
What are you talking about?
And And like I said, the vestiges of it are still there. And it's you know, you might say like, oh, the town's changed and people are different, but it's still wholly unwelcoming, you know? And even if like you think it's progressive and nice, it's not going to be in any way inviting to black people. It's not going to be in any way a space where black people are going to feel like,
I mean, I think welcomed and comfortable. I think you're going like way like down the like rabbit hole of why black people wouldn't want to live there. And the fact is, it doesn't matter what black people want or don't want.
I'm saying the people that live there justify by saying it's not the sundown town anymore. We don't mean to be it that way. It just is. Like, it just is because you make it fucking miserable for people of color.
I mean, even that I think is simplifying it. Like, to me, it's so much more fundamental. Like, a black person is never going to be shown a house in those neighborhoods. A black person is never going to be looking to even think about going to visit a home in those neighborhoods.
True.
A black person is not going to be able to afford a house in those neighborhoods.
A black person doesn't have the generational wealth and the connections.
This is what I'm talking about. Right. Like you're talking about like, oh, it's not welcome. Like, fuck welcome. Even if black people wanted to be in there, there would be so many things stopping them from even doing it that are fundamental that it doesn't matter. And that was the point of it.
Yeah. And we you know, I don't know if we talked about it on the show, but we've got a house now. Offer accepted. Been to inspection. We're going to be putting down roots. But we looked at a commercial property that had a condo as part of it. And just the thing that depressed me the most was that all the things that changed in that commercial zoning versus residential zoning, just like there was like 9 different things that were different in terms of the loan, the zoning, the environmental testing, phase this, that, 1, 2, all that shit was just like white, 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 white. Every single check was like, okay, who you know, gotta have connections, you gotta have this, you gotta have that. And it was depressing. It was really depressing. Just like, geez.
Yeah, because what it sets up is that people are saying like, oh, be an entrepreneur. You be an entrepreneur. It's like, okay, be an entrepreneur. That's
be
great.
White.
That's all sounds good and well. And I'm sure plenty of black people have aspirations to be entrepreneurs and are entrepreneurs. But when you look at the facts and how the systems are laid out, particularly banking in this country, you look at a situation of if you're a business owner and you need to have a physical space for your business, your best bet in terms of investment and return on investment is to own or at least be paying mortgage to the property that you occupy.
Yeah.
And black people are never able to do that because they've set up these commercial lending scenarios by which you literally need to have cash, entire cash, to pay for the building
gobs
that
of
you're
it.
Looking. And gobs of it. And it's just, it's
and
disgusting.
It's not even the cash. It, like, literally, the lending is not Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac guaranteed. So now it's local banking. It's who you know at a local banking level. And we know people. So we got into a bank and there was like 4 banks like, fuck no, or the conditions with which if we're going to lend you, very white guy, this amount of money for this building is going to have a cash reserve, all sorts of shit. It's crazy. It's so skewed towards just, I don't even call it nepotism. It's like, what's it like? It's opportunity hoarding. That's exactly what it is.
It's opportunity hoarding.
And I hadn't seen it.
And it's opportunity hoarding, and it's like the type of opportunity hoarding where people just like assume that that's the way things are, or that's how it is.
Right.
It's no big deal. It makes perfect sense, guys. Well,
if the opportunity has been hoarded for me and handed to me on a silver fucking platter, I don't complain. I'm like, oh, yay, cool.
Ridiculous.
Yeah. So, Sundown Town. You going to do the slang? You got a video for that?
Yeah, there's a video. I thought you were doing that.
I do. Okay, so we got Philadelphia slang. Everyone knows the John, interracial John. John is a word for anything and everything, but there's other Philadelphia slang, and there's a little BuzzFeed video about Philadelphia slang with some comedians.
Cool, you guys, on Philadelphia slang.
John, man.
Hey!
Maybe a tool of some sort.
The Philadelphia version of, like, the outhouse.
Is it like a joint?
Like, there's a couple different ways you can use it. One way, you're like, hey, come join my group. And then, like, this guy's my John because I asked him to join my group.
You can use John with anything. You can be like, yo, hey, them Johns is hot. Some of your shoes, you know what I'm saying? So it can mean anything.
It can mean anything,
you guys.
A person, place, or John.
It's true.
Drawling. I think of drawl, I think of like a southern drawl, but not somebody in Philly.
That doesn't sound like a good thing to be doing.
Shorty's so bad, she got your boy drawling over there, you know?
Probably not like drawing.
No.
Damn it.
Taking too long to get ready, like your girl, like she's drawling.
Acting out of character, not letting someone
be
themselves.
My mom was drawling, asking me to get plane tickets for my brother's wedding.
School kill. That sounds kind of crazy.
You have your first day.
I said that earlier in the episode.
Outfit ready to go. It's on point. Your John is on point. That's your school kill outfit.
You're like cool when you're like in a crowd, but like by yourself, you're like a weirdo.
Sounds like a French rapper.
This isn't slang.
I guess it's a French rapper who moved to Philadelphia when he was around 16.
The school kill is like a road you take to get to Philly
and a river.
There's traffic on the school kill.
Ard. We went to the Ard last weekend. It was crazy.
Like when you're going to go ham, we're going to go Ard.
Pirates come from Philadelphia and Ard is something that you guys just say.
No, it means all right.
No, man, you didn't totally waste your architecture degree. It's Ard. With or without.
No onions on a cheesesteak, right?
Oh, that's without cheese, right?
The cheese on there, but without the ketchup. You know what I'm saying? On your Philly cheesesteak or something like that.
Without.
I love all this slang.
So that they didn't get some other ones in there. I'm kind of surprised. When you had
which
other,
one? Jeet Yet would have been, yeah, been there for sure. Jeet Yet.
It's like the, I guess used isn't really a Philly slang, but I've never heard any group of community or individuals use Philadelphia.
Use guys
ready to order yet?
Mm-hmm. Jeet
Yet guys coming over.
The ultimate. And the Eagles, that'd be the other one.
How about Wooder?
Oh, yeah, Wooder, duh.
Like,
yeah,
Wooder. Like, you mean like H2O, Wooder? That was like when we were in New Orleans.
Oh, don't get me started about New Orleans accents, because that was just confusing all the time.
Earl.
Olive Earl. Toilet paper. Anyways, I think that brings us to the end of our show today.
What?
Yes, that's it. All right. Nice, short, and sweet. Short and sweet episode.
You're working. You got phone calls and busy. You're crazy.
I am crazy. Again, you can find us on iTunes or Stitcher Radio. Just search Interracial John. That's JAWN. Or you can go to our website, interracialjohn.com. You can find us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, Tumblr at Interracial John. That's JAWN. You can find me on Twitter at Leslie Mac, MAC. And you can find that guy at Very A White A Guy. And I think that's it.
That's it.
Good night, everybody.
High five.